So I figured I'd start with a little bit of background about the book of Ecclesiastes. The proper name of the book is Qohelet. Ecclesiastes is actually a Latin transliteration of the Greek rendering of the Hebrew pen name of the author. So it's a horrible mangling through lots of translations that got us to the title Ecclesiastes for the book. So it went through at least two different languages before it got to us as Ecclesiastes. But the Hebrew word is Qohelet, which literally means gatherer or acquirer of wisdom, wealth, or pleasures. So that's why I titled the session Qohelet before I titled it Ecclesiastes. Everybody knows it as the mangled word, which we have inherited. And so it's often mistranslated as teacher or gatherer of apostles because of the three languages that it's gone through. But it's closer to gatherer of wisdom, is the title of the book. It's a book from probably the post-exilic period of Israel, so after Babylon came through, sacked everything, made everybody dispersed to the seven winds, and everybody was in exile in Babylon. That's probably about when this was written. So it's after the temple has been destroyed, things are looking less hopeful in the world. So with that little bit of introduction, I would like to, if somebody would like to read, we're just going to do the chapter 1, verses 1 through 11. Get the introductory poem of Qohelet.
I'll do it. The words of the teacher, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the teacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes, a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hurries to places where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes to the north. Round and round the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea. The sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, but there they continue to flow. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them.
So is anyone depressed yet? usually when people think of Qohelet or Ecclesiastes, they think of this, it's infamous for this, the vanity of vanities, and this sort of almost a proto existentialism, or an early existentialism, where it's like, you know, everything's just pointless, life is full of woe. But one commentator, Norbert Lofink, cautions that the greatest difficulty for modern readers of this poem is that our spontaneous reaction is to judge that it is a negative and depressing message. And if we cannot break free of this prejudice, then we simply miss entry into the poem. He will go on to say that this poem is all about praise and glory, which I have trouble finding in there because it's so, I mean, even with sort of looking past my prejudices, thinking that this is very depressing passage. It's hard to see it as all something glorious. And I mean, because you hear over and over again sort of like the lamenting of how, you know, vain everything is. And so one of the ways, one of the things I want to focus on is that word that is translated so commonly as vanity of vanities. And the reason why it's repeated so quickly after itself is in Hebrew, that's the way you intensify something. You make, to say something is, like, it's like saying something is really, really bad. You just say the word again. It's hebel, hebel, you know, a vanity of vanities. The word is HBL, hebel. This is just a few different translations. NRSV says vanity of vanities. Then the Tanakh has it utter futility, utter futility. And then the egalitarian translation says completely illusory, a breath, a puff of breath, is from loafing. And from just these few translations, you can see that it's hard to get a good English equivalent of the Hebrew word hebel. But it's very central, I think, to entering into this poem and trying to see something a little bit deeper than just an existentialist sort of depressing view. The Anchor Bible Commentary lists the literal meanings of hebel as breath, whiff, puff, and steam. And then it doesn't skip a breath to say that it can also refer to anything that is superficial, ephemeral, insubstantial, incomprehensible, enigmatic, inconsistent, or contradictory, something that cannot be grasped or controlled, something that is incomprehensible, unknowable, mysterious, ironic, enigmatic, or absurd. So that sure narrows it down a bit, huh? Yes?
I was just looking, I've got a copy of the Message, which is a paraphrase, and he translates it as smoke.
As smoke, yeah. And so there's this large breadth of and range of meaning for this one little word that is repeated intentionally at the beginning of this text. And it's hard to, just simply translate it as vanity and leave it at that, I don't think captures the whole breadth of the meaning. Let's see, where was I? So one key insight into how to read this phrase, I mean, because we have such a broad range of meaning for the phrase, is to look at the context in the verse. And I think one good lens to understand what we mean by hebel is to look at the question that happens in verse 3, which is what is humankind's benefit for all of its labor under the sun? That question starts to turn the path meaning of the passage towards what people do, people's works, people's labor. And if you look at it that way, you start to think about vanity or hebel as in the same way, like, if our works are vanity, what are our works? They're our attempt to affect the world. There are attempts to control things, to do things, to accomplish salvation, if you will. And so thinking about it as in relation to that, you can go towards the broader range of meaning of hebel to be trying to control things or our attempt to get a handle on stuff or the ability to understand. So if everything is pointless that we do, it's a very different poem than if everything is just pointless. And if you center it on works, it sounds a little more like Luther than it does like a existentialist to say. And so one of the things that I have done, if you read the title I put for this course, is to translate hebel in metaphor. Because it has such a broad range of meaning, it's nicer to translate it as metaphor. So like smoke is a good one. I prefer like mist through your fingers, because it shows you're trying to like grasp onto something and it just goes and falls straight through. I lost my train of thought. Does anybody have any questions while I'm trying to regroup myself here? I mean, if we can't say anything adequately about Hebbel, we can at least say some things inadequately about it. We can attempt to get towards a better definition of what it is to be what it is to be Hebbel, to be breath, or to be mist through your fingers, something that cannot be grasped or controlled. And so, I mean, vanity does have several other connotations, like human self-centeredness, which are useful for a Lutheran interpretation of Colette, but those are... May not be true to the Augustine tenure, because I'm trying to read Luther into this, perhaps, but it's the getting caught up in ourselves that comes up again and again in Colette. He talks about let's go back to the text, because I'm getting far away from it. The life-giving part of this text that is really hard to see in this poem really comes in his appreciation of creation. Because the part about the sun rises and goes down and hurries to the place where it rises, the wind blows to the south and goes around to the north, round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. And the streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full to the place where the streams flow. They continue to flow. So there's this sort of awe about creation and how everything works in these nice cycles. Everything recycles into itself, and it's all part of this great system and perfection. And the vanity is that no matter what he does, he can't be a part of that. The human works all disappear. All our words are wearisome. Verse 8, it says in the NRSV things, but I really like the translation words, because words, which is another possible meaning of the Hebrew is words, because words are another way to control things. It's another way to try to put our understanding out onto things. All words, all our ability to describe things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with the hearing, and the ear is not filled with the hearing. The eye is not satisfied with the seeing, the ear is not filled with the hearing. I find that as well to be a bit of grace, a bit of God's grace, because even though there is nothing new under the sun, there is nothing new out there. Everything that we do is just a repetition of the history, according to Colette. We will never be satisfied with our seeing. There will always be things that astonish us. There will always be beautiful things to discover. And our ears will never be filled with all of the things that we hear. We can always hear more. We can always listen to the world. So it's my hope that continuing to explore through this, that you will hear in new ways this poem of Colette. It might not be what Lofink thinks as this great hymn of praise, but...
A question that I would bring to this text is, to what end... So I see this opening poem as sort of trying to like burst the bubble of human pretension in some ways. Mm-hmm. And Continuing on there from verse 12, it talks about the wisdom itself is verse 18. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and those who increase knowledge increase sorrow. So it's really trying to kind of burst the bubble on all human pretensions. But do we believe the writer in saying that, right? Because they obviously wrote this.
And they called themselves a collector of wisdom.
Right, right. And so what is the wisdom that Qohelet lifts up, and what is the wisdom that, because there is a certain wisdom that Qohelet believes that we should seek to acquire, and another that that it needs to be whose pretensions need to be burst. And I like your focus on the observation of the natural world in these opening verses from verse 5 to verse 11. I think there's really something there. That's where somehow true wisdom is to be found.
Yeah, within the context of the full book of Qohelet, there is still this this idea that things are vain and things are impossible to grasp onto. But it becomes apparent that the wisdom that Qohelet is taking apart is that the only response possible to the fact that all is vanity is to accept the gift of joy whenever it is possible to do so. People must not brood over all their days of misery because God has given them a grant, and that grant comes with the authorization to enjoy all that they have received. So eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. Mm-hmm. Which is not quite exactly from Qohelet, but it's close. It might as well be from Ecclesiastes. I think there's something close to that here. So the wisdom is that God, and so do you hear Luther in that? God has given us a grant, and that is that we have the ability to enjoy things, and that we should, and that we have the authorization from God to enjoy all that you have received through this endless ability to see and see and connect with creation.
Well, I think it's a comfort because, we all know, I was telling somebody at breakfast that my mother and three of her brothers wrote memoirs. And when I was reading all four of them, I said to the writers, are you sure you lived in the same family? Because we all see things in different ways. And so what this is telling me is I can go and see and look and do, and no, I won't get any great wisdom perhaps or change the world. The more history you study, the more you learn it hasn't changed. We've got electricity, but they had a lot of good things back there too. This is the Roman bathrooms and all that stuff. But I have the opportunity to do it my way. I have the opportunity to come to some of this, just like my mother and her three brothers did. We all saw it out of different eyes. And so I can go this way or that way or whatever way and not worry that I'm gonna fall down someplace and be totally destroyed. Because it's all gonna rotate. It's gonna come back again. My kids will be different from me. My parents were different. But we all still are living in this human world.
The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will they be any remembrance of people yet to come.
Yeah. Kind of on a similar train of thought, but also different. Again, still focusing on verses 9 and 10. There is nothing new under the sun part. I think a lot of times today we have, like every generation and every time, we have this idea that, everything we're doing now is new and different and we're very unique. And it's kind of a way of knocking people off their high horse and saying, well, yes, technologies may have changed, but human nature is still the same as it always was.
Yeah, and that's another way, I think, in which this really sort of has a proto-Luther because it's all about undoing hubris, undoing the sin of pride, the breaking of the first commandment, saying that I am better than God, I can I can achieve salvation. I can do this myself. And it's like, the Ecclesiastes is like, no, you can't. And you are nothing. You are dust. You are no better than a rock. There's nothing new under the sun, neither are you. But through God's grace, there is this great gift of creation, of this perfect world out there that we can never get tired of seeing. Everything that we do is misdirected. But God, in God, there is grace.
You know what I see from this? I'm reading on. He talks about how he has slaves and he built houses and he found pleasure. This is what struck me. I found pleasure in my toil, and that was my reward. So what I'm seeing is the process of gaining wisdom is as important as the product of wisdom, because you can't really, that's just going to go away. So it's what we learn as we go along that's important. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So. And he'll go on to say even the pleasure he finds in his toil is also vanity.
That isn't true. Oh, dang.
he'll even dismiss that.
Oh, so that's part of of his process, is deciding even the process isn't any good.
Even the process is... there's still the pleasure, and that is the gift from God.
Anytime
there is pleasure, anytime there is goodness in life, it is a great gift from God, because everything without God is just vanity, is just mystery things.
I see.
Heaven, if you will.
Yeah, I grabbed the Lutheran Study Bible, so see where it is, where this statement is. I think it's fitting that what we've said so far. How does Luther interpret the phrase, there's nothing new under the sun? Luther notes that while God certainly does new things, people remain sinful, unable to do anything truly new under the sun, that is, in the world. So the notion of sin, and I don't have a lot of theological training, but I still retain the notion of the ink bottle being thrown by Luther, if I remember correctly, he was acknowledging that he just couldn't overcome his sins. There's nothing he could do about it.
Nothing you can do about it, yeah. And then again, it's only through God are there new things under the sun. Only through God is there a continuing creation in the world to look at and to hear. Yeah.
So that's the continuation of it. So
yeah. It's interesting, the phrase under the sun is unique to Ecclesiastes. It's a near synonym for under the heavens, which appears elsewhere, but only in Colette do we have it as under the sun, which is, I think that's rather interesting.
Mm.
The sun refers to like the realm of the living as opposed to the realm of the dead. And so because he's talking about this, this realm of the living under the sun, it's again harder to look at it as just the proto-existentialist view, because he's still talking about what's alive.
This historical context of its composition, you're saying, is post-exilic?
Probably, yeah.
It's interesting to think so. So the Hebrew people have experienced exile. They've experienced basically the Old Testament version of a crucifixion, but it's a crucifixion of their entire body politic their entire community. They've gone into exile, seen the decimation of Jerusalem and their temple. And so on the other side of that comes this wisdom tradition that really takes the long view, right?
Yeah.
It's like it really takes the long view. I mean, they've seen everything decimated, and they're finding the presence and workings of God in just the workings of nature, and really the long view of that's beyond kind of the horizon of our understanding.
And that's one of the cultural barriers as well to us engaging this text, because as modern readers, we just see vanity, vanity, everything is vanity, and we're just sort of slogged down by it. But this is written as just a passionate plea about the way the world is. This is a lived sort of ground up feeling that it brings. Like the theology of the people of El Salvador and the theology of the cross that comes out of places like that, where people have still a very large and current scar from just the falling apart of humanity. Their world has been constantly trodden on and just shattered down. And so, as modern readers, it's hard for us to see that as this is what he's writing from. This is what life is, and he's still trying to find the grace that sort of just a little bit seeps through, and only by the grace of God does it get there in this poem at the beginning.
Well, going back to his bubble, I teach English as a second language, and I am constantly embarrassed. As we talk, as they get more language to talk and ask questions, because you're alluding to the fact that America has never had any of these sufferings either. And so it's so difficult. We think we are the top of everything. And everything starts here, and we've climbed up, and we're going to keep on climbing. And yet you go back, I remember one of my students from Cambodia, and this was during the Vietnam War, and the Cambodians were just nothing. They had no culture. We were so kind to bring them in here and all that. And then I went to a museum, I think it was in San Francisco, and they had the most fantastic Cambodian history section. And Cambodia has had just wonderful culture. Maybe they didn't have electric lights, but they have had the education, the history, the knowledge and the spirituality that got lost in all the trauma of what he's talking about. That we've not really experienced that a lot. I mean, we've had wars, we've had deaths, we've had this and that, we've had depressions, but we've continued up the ladder. And the students are kind of, as I said, they make me embarrassed when they ask questions about America and what its view is, or what. Why do they act like this or that or whatever?
Well, I think it's interesting where that comes from, because I think it is sort of a myth that we have not experienced suffering or being run roughshod over or brokenness as a country, but for some reason we have this idea that we haven't. We have this notion that because we're America, we just have this myth of progress. We're always going forward, no matter what it is that has happened. We're still all for the better. Ecclesiastes flies in the face of all of that and says, "No,
we weren't even a power for years and years and years, but somehow now I'm starting to see some kind of turns." Because there have been some discussions about we're losing some of our ability with, you know, the energy crisis and pollution and all this and what's going to happen, but we know we can solve it. But it's just a matter of time before we solve this problem. Yeah, I agree. We've had wars and we've had depressions and we've had deaths. And,
we just don't have the memory of them, as we don't have the festering wound of them, because we try to, we just cover it up. Or if, not that we don't have it, we cover it up with this other thing, this American dream.
I have this distinct memory of September 11th, and this guy, this... it was someone who was working in, it was probably September 12th, probably the next day, someone who was working in just the rubble, and a police officer or a firefighter, or it was someone, anyway, he was saying, he was just covered with dust, and he said, we're just trying to get back to a sense of normalcy. I mean, who can fault a person in such a situation for kind of saying something that didn't make any sense? But really, normalcy? Like, you know, it was just like kind of absurd statement. But it kind of an American. There's something about that is American of American. Like, oh, we just gotta like
gotta get back to being normal.
You gotta get back to being normal, or as if that could be the case, you know?
What is crooked cannot be made straight, but is lacking cannot be cut.
Well, our optimism is a good trait, but on the other hand, it hides reality, perhaps. And this brings us back to, you know, human nature, the nature of the world, the good and the evil, the misfortune that...
I mean, the United States are all very, very happy to be here. But at the same time, I think we have to be looking back here, that we're part of a circle.
So what do people gain from all the toil at which they work under the sun?
What verse is that? Are you?
That's verse 3.
3?
The unanswered question.
Well, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates say that they shouldn't leave it all to their children because it will be to their deficit if you toil that much and pile up that much. So it's probably one way to look at it.
I think it's a really layered question. There's a lots of layers in which when you answer that question, I can think of it personally, but also in our corporate sense, you know, when I get done with, and I've done something well, I don't think about the fact that it's temporal. You know, raising my kids, I don't think about the fact that that's a temporal thing, that will be gone when they're gone, when I'm gone. So this text, to me, part of what this text does is always calls it back to the largeness of things, just the grandness of things. I was thinking as I was reading about the scientific, you know, just the discoveries of more and more we discover how the world is put together, and yet we know less and less about how it's put together.
Yeah.
Just the broadness. There is nothing new under the sun. It's all been there. It was all there when it started. And we've just kind of been rearranging it. But it seems like it's a really layered question. There's, you know.
Thank you.
More knowledge leads to sadness, because the more you know, the less you know very little. Yeah.
There's a kind of comfort in that too. There's a kind of sense of, you know, being in the midst of a leveling, I guess. There's a leveling to it. Maybe comfort isn't quite the right word.
When I hear this, it speaks to me sort of what we were learning about at Easter, that the stewardship that we are given as part of the everlasting covenant of this planet, what do people gain from all the toil at which they toil in the sun? Well, we are all stewards of this planet, and so it's not necessarily a selfish gain in this sense. It's a gain for the greater good of all of God's creation, of which we are stewards, but we are more a part of than lords over. I think that the more and more we toil at that, and toil at realizing that, the more and more we are given that sense of kind of the Kantian sense of what the sublime is, that we are a very minuscule part of this huge creation, that that is our part, that we're all kind of cogs.
It's hard to hear some of the people if they don't speak a little louder, but we were talking about, I've heard the word American exceptionalism lately, about, and I interpret it to mean that America is so different from every other country, but I've traveled very little in the world, but have been to Vienna, and I think that demonstrated to me that ultra wealthy, 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 wealthy royalty, whose daughter married Napoleon and the Austro-Hungarian wars and on, war and riches and summer homes that were as big as the whole acreage of Holden. And so that verse, what do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? It's not limited to America. To look back in history, and not only Eastern countries, but European countries, just unbelievable wealth and poverty side by side.
So does this notion of toil imply what we do for personal gain or toil or work on behalf of creation or stewardship of creation? Or is there a distinguishing between toil for the common good and toil for personal gain? Or is that just an open question?
Yeah, I'm not sure Colette will make the distinction between works for one thing or another. He talks more about toil in chapter 2, verse 18. I hated all my toil in which I had toiled in the sun, seeing that I must leave it to those who come after me, and who knows whether they will be wise or foolish, yet they will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is hevel for vanity. So I turned and gave up my heart to despair concerning all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes one who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave all to be enjoyed by another who did not toil for it. This also is hevel and a great evil. What do mortals get from all the toil and strain with which they toil under the sun? For all of their days are full of pain, and their work is a vexation. Even at night, their minds do not rest. This also is hevel.
So clearly, the author was a nihilist.
But then,
and then the next verse, though, there is nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. This also I saw from the hand of God.
If you go, I read ahead a little bit here. If you go into chapter 3, verse 12 and 13, it says, I know that there is nothing better for them to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. Moreover, it is God's gift that we should eat and drink and take pleasure in all their toil.
Yeah, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we do not. For apart from God, who can eat or have enjoyment? For the one who pleases God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, God gives the work of gathering and reaping, and only to the one who pleases God. This also is hevel and a chasing after the wind.
So is this saying that we should see our toils as ministry?
There's the Lutheran notion that our work is for the people and not for God.
our toil is for us. Our toil is for other people. We work to help others, to be able Christ for other people.
Doesn't that ultimately make it for God as well?
Yeah.
It's part of
well,
creation.
It ultimately, for God, it is nothing. The very fact that we can work in toil is a gift from God. And all of the worth is only from God. And God gives us the gift of being able to eat and drink and find merriment.
Well, Luther, one of the things that he stressed was that, that he took away the idea of vocation as being a call from God to religious service, of being a priest, nun, monk, or whatever. But he said that vocation is a call from God of any kind. It's called to do any kind of work, any kind of service, or any kind of toil. So you have that whole idea that there isn't, the toil is not necessarily specifically a quote religious toil, but it is a toil that we need to do all the time.
This is maybe a little facetious, but when I was a kid in the old German Lutheran church, there was a hymn, "Work for the Night is Coming," and I thought that meant work, because it's going to be night. I didn't get the theological part of it at all, but I don't think they read Ecclesiastes when I was a child.
Some of the toil, when I first saw that, it popped into my head. When you see some kids at school, a lot of people have to have working mothers and fathers, and a lot of people want to work. But the sad part is when I see children who own everything, there is nothing their family doesn't buy them, except the opportunity to be with the family. And it's a real challenge and a real struggle. But to me, that is toiling in vanity. These children are just dying for attention. And at school, they cluster, you know, and they don't get that. Now, there's others who get both. They maybe not quite as much stuff, but they get their parents' love. They get their parents' attention. And that's what the kids really, despite what they say sometimes, that's what they're really looking for, is that love and attention. And if they don't get it at home, then they're begging it from the teachers, who are unable to do it because if you touch the kids, you're in trouble. But otherwise, I think the vanity part comes from misusing our time and not realizing you need it here, yes. You need it here, yes. But you also need it here, yes. And don't leave one of those needing it here's out.
And there's also a call to stop and appreciate creation.
Mm-hmm.
To appreciate.
Stop and smell the roses.
The world around you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's very present in Kohler. Then we get the famous thing, you know, with the Beatles song, "For Every Season." I mean, for everything there's a season, and every.
The birds.
Peter Seeger.
The
young kids. There's a song, Poppy. Yeah, I'm totally cultured.
I see so much of that too happening here in this stuff of the whole Buddhist concept of mindfulness. There's really dwelling around that whole thing. Just focusing on what's happening right at this moment, rather than that back forward.
Yeah.
I was thinking the same thing in terms of a Buddhist image of that what suffering is attachment. And then when you get attached to the things that you do, be they good or ill, suffering will come. And this sense here of lack of attachment. I mean, you can get attached to it, but it's always going to go. It doesn't matter whether it's the greatest or the smallest. It's always going to go. And so be present for the moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had that same thing, same kind of sense. All right. There's a terrible clarity about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's you can tell how important the question is, what do people gain from their toil, because it happens so many times in Coalette. I mean, again, in chapter 3, what gain have the workers from their toil? I have seen the business that God has given to everyone to be busy with. He has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds, yet they cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to be happy and to enjoy themselves as long as they live. Moreover, it is God's gift that all should eat and drink and take pleasure in all of their toil. I know that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done this so that all should stand in awe before God. That which is already has been. That which is to be already is. And God seeks out what has gone by. And so that's a long way from, you know, everything is vanity. All everything is pointless.
I think that's my view of it, though. It seems, it seems like what the beginning part of this is, it's setting up a cultural context of sort of the cynicism of toil and how that's sort of the wrong attitude to have about it. And I think we can apply that all to our lives when we read this, instead of seeing our jobs as just labor to earn money. The work that we do for everybody is ministry to the whole creation. We are not just working for ourselves, but in our actions and in our deeds, they are for Christ. They will always, at some point, have an effect. It seems like that's a good driving.
Taking my word it's not everything is in vain, it's everything is ephemeral. This too shall pass. So ultimately, why do we toil? Won't matter later.
Everything is. The other thing about translating it as sort of mist between your fingers is that everything is not ours to control. It's not ours to take hold of and have for ourselves. You can't capture this. You can't take in the whole world. You think you're on your own? No, but no. It's, and so the world is instead to wash upon you. The mist is to wash through you. You're to be immersed in this. And your fingers are to flow through it, but it's not yours to take. So,
in order to take credit for.
Yeah, or to take credit for. Yeah. There's a whole notion of trying to earn your way to heaven through your works. Coelette and Luther both will say. No, it's only by God's grace alone that you get there to salvation.
Get more grace than you do a lot of good stuff.
Extra grace, more grace.
Extra grace.
Blessing.
You get your grace points for the day.
Extra credit.
Gotta get enough kudos.
Well, that's where the parable of the workers in the field, and they all start at different times, and then get the same reward.
Yeah. So before we draw to a close, I want to lift up at least one more way in which I consider Coelette to be a proto kind of Lutheran text. And one well-known methodology of Luther, especially in his catechisms, that the form of the work itself of the catechisms, the way in which it's structured, is supposed to do faith to people. It's supposed to grab you and drag you through faith. And I think Coelette is written with much the same kind of theology of structure. The way the book is formed with the starting poem and with the repetition of vanity and the repetition of this question of what makes what benefit do we get from our toil? It just drags you through this. It sort of does something to you. There's a way in which Colette leaps off the page and grabs you and takes you through this journey of life that that other books kind of. It's very Lutheran in the way it does that. It does things to you. I think you can't read Ecclesiastes and just put it back down and say, oh well. As maybe a nihilist would do. Any other last comments, concerns, or questions?
Well, I think the book talks about wisdom and letting go, and I've been doing a lot of entering the third stage of life and reading a lot about that. There's so much written about that now, about the idea as we enter that stage of life, we become wiser, and part of the wisdom of that stage is we let go. Those things that were so important to us and we sought after so much, now we look at it and say, big deal. No, it doesn't mean anything. It's bad.
Any other
sort of a half-formed thought about the Proverbs in the rest of the book, particularly the section for chapter 10 in my book, it's just marked miscellaneous observations. So just kind of throughout Ecclesiastes, there's these proverbs in the text. But then there's also the reminder, this too is missed between our fingers. But half-formed idea, there it is. There's a connection there. I don't have it yet.
Should I leave you with this last thought from close to the end of the book? Banish anxiety from your mind and put away pain from your body, for youth and the dawn of life are heaven.
It's good for us old people.
Thank you.